From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the most powerful investors in the world, George Soros. He became known as the man who broke the Bank of England after his fund made $1 billion in 1 week, betting against the pound in the currency market. But Soros doesn't just make money, he gives it away. He's funded projects that promote democracy, education, peace, and culture in Eastern Europe, Bosnia, South Africa, and the former Soviet Union. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Emmylou Harris' new album, Wrecking Ball, produced by Daniel Lanois. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. House Speaker Newt Gingrich has now withdrawn his offer to increase the nation's debt ceiling temporarily while the administration and Congress work out their differences over the budget. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
At the end of this month, the government will run out of the ability to borrow funds to meet its financial obligations unless Congress passes a law raising the debt limit. But Republicans have been refusing to do that unless the president agrees to their 7-year balanced budget plan. Yesterday, the Treasury Department cut back on its short-term lending and urged Congress to pass the debt limit extension. At first, House Speaker Newt Gingrich said he would agree to raise the debt limit for a temporary period of 2 weeks, an offer the White House immediately accepted. But then Gingrich changed his mind, saying he's not convinced the government will actually run out of money at the end of the month. Republicans now say they want Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin to come to the Hill and testify about the matter. Many Republicans are loath to give up the threat of a default, which could give them greater leverage over the president in budget negotiations. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Clinton administration has released new orders for law enforcement officials. The new policy was released to a Senate committee looking into the standoff with white separatists at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, in 1992. The panel's chairman, Senator Arlen Specter, says he congratulates the Justice Department for issuing the guidelines. The policy says an agent may shoot only when there is a reasonable belief that the agent or others are in imminent danger. The policy requires agents to give verbal warnings before using deadly force. Warning shots are not authorized in most cases. In the wake of the Million Man March, several members of Congress, black and white, are calling on President Clinton to appoint a commission to study race relations. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
African-American leaders are calling on Mr. Clinton to help map out a plan for improving race relations and conditions in black communities. Several members of Congress have sent the president a letter urging him to appoint a commission on race relations and issue a report on the progress and failures that the nation has made on race. Calls for the White House to help improve race relations have also come from those outside of Congress. Civil rights leader Jesse Jackson wants Mr. Clinton to convene a White House conference on urban policy and economic development. Meanwhile, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, a co-organizer of the Million Man March, is disputing police estimates on the number of people who attended the event. He's instructed his lawyers to go to court to seek a recount of official numbers that showed only 400,000 people were at Monday's march. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The government reports there was a 21% reduction in the nation's trade deficit in August. The trade gap narrowed to $8.82 billion, reflecting export sales of commercial aircraft, computers, and semiconductors. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 11 points at 4,784. This is NPR. U.S. Senate backers have stripped most controversial provision of a bill tightening sanctions against Cuba. This will clear the way for later passage of the bill. The provision, which is opposed by the White House and Senate Democrats, would allow naturalized Cuban Americans to sue anyone who traffics in the property they had seized from them. Critics had said the trafficking provision would open the floodgates to possibly hundreds of thousands of lawsuits and threaten to open up similar claims by naturalized Americans who fled other countries. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has announced the location for Bosnian peace talks, which will be held in the United States at the end of the month. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio, has been chosen for the peace talks. Secretary of State Christopher told the House National Security Committee that privacy was a prime consideration in selecting the 8,100-acre site.
That site provides us, we believe, with a very optimum set of facilities for the three delegations and for the members of the contact group who will be there to try to facilitate the discussions. The site also affords the kind of privacy that is necessary, we believe, to conduct a successful negotiation.
The presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia are all expected to be on hand for the negotiations, which will be led by Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke. Christopher says the talks will concentrate on immensely difficult issues, including territory, elections, and the return of refugees. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The search continues for people missing from the sunken barge in the Gulf of Mexico. The U.S. Coast Guard has joined the effort. A spokesman says weather conditions are improving the chances that those unaccounted for can be found. The barge went down overnight Sunday with 245 people aboard. It was buffeted by then-Hurricane Roxanne. 236 people were rescued. At least three people died. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, George Soros, is perhaps the most powerful and successful private investor in the world. He made his fortune speculating on foreign currency. Time magazine described him as making money and giving it away faster than any individual alive. Soros has poured millions of dollars of profits into his Open Society Foundation, which gives grants to projects that promote democracy, education, information dissemination, and culture in Eastern Europe, Bosnia, South Africa, and the former Soviet Union. Fred Kuhne was funded by Soros to rebuild water and gas lines in Sarajevo while the city was under siege. Soros is a complex figure, a ruthless investor, a humanitarian philanthropist. Time magazine put Soros on the cover last July and headlined the story, "The Billionaire Who Would Save the World and Can Almost Afford to." Soros has a new book called Soros on Soros. I asked George Soros if he would give us some figures, how much he's worth, how much he's given away.
Well, since I have to make the money before I can give it away, the funds that I manage are now have a size of about $12 billion. I don't disclose my own wealth, but I'm participating in the profits. And as a general principle, I give away the maximum that I can under the current tax laws, which is 50% of my income. And that is the basis of the foundation's activities. And foundations sort of spend an average of now of about $300 million a year. This has grown very rapidly from, let's say, $3 million when I started in 1979. And then it accelerated tremendously around 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, and suddenly it was possible to establish foundations in all the countries that were previously communist.
Now, early on in your financial career, what motivated you to make money, to make a lot of money?
Well, actually, it was a need for money because I left Hungary when I was 17 years old and I had absolutely no financial resources. And I was really penniless at one time. And I studied. I worked my way through college, which is very unusual in England because most people at that time had a grant from their local authority. I just had to earn my living. And I found my way into the financial markets after a very different start. And then I moved to the United States in 1956. I had a five-year plan in nice communist fashion of wanting to make $100,000, save it up, and then I could retire and live on partly on the income and whatever else, writing or whatever else I would do. And unlike the communist five-year plans, I over accomplished it, and I got got involved in making money, and it was a very exciting activity, you know, full of adventures and interest. So I got very caught up in it. At the same time, it was also very painful, a thing, tremendous pressure. And so when I, around 1979, when the fund reached the size of 100 million and my own personal wealth was maybe in the region of 20 million or so, 20, 25 million, I decided that I've got enough money, in fact, more than what's good for the health of my family, and set up the Open Society Fund. Foundation.
When you say you had more money than was good for the health of your family, what do you mean?
Well, I think that it's very tough for rich kids, you know.
How?
I mean, it's because you don't have the constraints that affect other people. You've got a lot of money. It's difficult to find motivation. I don't think it's that healthy.
Now, you made your fortune in a controversial type of investment, the hedge fund, which from what I understand is very risky but potentially very lucrative. It's an investment partnership. It's very speculative. The goal is to make huge profits quickly by making huge investments, which are highly leveraged, which is to say that a lot of the investment money is money you've borrowed. Now, this is controversial because if you're making huge bets on foreign currency, as you've often done, you can play havoc with that currency. For example, you bet roughly, I guess, $10 billion against the British pound and made $1 billion in 1992, became known as the man who broke the British bank because the pound was so devalued by the time this was over.
Right. Well, you see, there's a lot of myth surrounding this. The activities of a hedge fund are as speculative as the person running it makes it.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very good form of investing because you have the same interests as your investors. You take not a fixed fee, but a percentage of the profits. And so your interest is the same as your shareholder. You want to get the best possible return commensurate with the risk you're willing to take. Now, it is, of course, risky because there's a certain imbalance between the upside and the downside. In other words, you get a share of the profits, but if you lose the money, well, you don't take a part of the loss. But since I kept my share of the profits in the fund, as the fund developed, I had the same downside risk as the other shareholders. So that was a very good format for the shareholders and for the managers, provided it's run by responsible people. There is a flaw in it. If people start losing money and then they double their risk, hoping to recapture it, they can actually get wiped out. And from time to time, people running hedge funds do get wiped out.
Now, when you bet against the British pound in 92, by the time everything was over, the British government lost $6 billion because the pound was so devalued.
Well, that was their responsibility. You see, they were on the other side of the trade. They were buying the sterling that I was selling. Whenever you have a trade, there is somebody on the other side. In this case, you could identify the person who was on the other side, and he was actually losing money.
So when you make a lot of money, does that always mean somebody else is losing a lot of money?
No, it doesn't. It's not a zero-sum game, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that we buy from may be taking profits. And generally, it's not really our job to look after the welfare of the people who are on the other side of a trade. So it's not, you know, anybody who buys in the market buys from someone. It's a fungible activity, and usually you don't hurt someone by buying from him. And in any case, he's a willing seller. So there, this kind of moral consideration doesn't enter into it. Now, I must say that once I became such a guru in the financial markets that I could actually influence other people's activities, there is then now an additional responsibility on me, because I can now, if I don't watch out, move markets, and that can be destabilizing. So I'm aware of this, and I try to avoid it.
In your new book, Soros on Soros, you say that the junk bond investors of the 80s had an amoral attitude toward investing. What does that mean, an amoral attitude toward investing, and how do you think that compares to your attitude toward investing, where there are often losers on the other end?
Well, that's actually a very good question, because my attitude is also an amoral attitude in the sense that I'm not unduly concerned with the social implications of my investments. I mean, I don't restrain, let's say, I don't refuse to buy defense stocks, let's say, because I think it's one shouldn't be killing people with weapons, or I don't abstain from buying tobacco stocks because it's bad for your health. So the markets are, in fact, not guided by moral considerations, and any moral constraints need to be introduced into the market through regulation. I was talking about something else in connection with the hedge fund people, and that was how they treated their customers. They really...
You mean the junk bond people?
The junk bond people, yeah. Sorry. There was a certain attitude which I didn't want to see in my partners. You see, we have a very, how shall I say, a great sense of, let's say, loyalty within the partnership. And those people did not fit into that because... they really got did anything they could get away with, whereas we do anything that is legally allowed and which also meets some moral constraints as to what is right. For instance, what I just said, that I don't deliberately go out of my way to destabilize a currency.
Now, I find it very interesting that you're not concerned with the social implications of your investments. For instance, you'll invest in weapons or tobacco. Right. On the other hand, you use so much of your profits for social reasons.
Right.
You know, because
yes.
you're investing in many parts of the world to in ways that really help people. So it's just interesting to me. You don't care how you make the money or if people get hurt
care.
Or whatever.
No,
but then the money's used for very humanitarian reasons.
Well, first of all, I shouldn't pretend to be holier than I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, I only give away part of the money I make.
Right.
But I also do have some moral constraints. However, I recognize that. You really can't change things by restraining, let's say, abstaining from buying certain kinds of stocks. There are exceptions to this. Now that I'm, let's say, such a public figure, I discovered that I had shares in a company that makes landmines. It was actually a very profitable company. But I sold my shares because I'm very much concerned about the horrible damage that landmines make. And in fact, we are looking for ways to have them removed. And therefore, I found it incompatible that I should actually have a significant stake in that company. But I would not have any, let's say... opprobrium of an anonymous investor owning some shares in that company, because that is really not what will make the difference to the removal of landmines.
George Soros is my guest, and he's considered to be the most powerful and successful private investor in the world today. And he has a new book called Soros on Soros. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is billionaire and philanthropist George Soros. How did you start using your profits to give grants to people in other countries?
Well, I started as an amateur. I recognized all the pitfalls that are involved in it. At the time, I tried to be anonymous, and so I was not professional about it. And I just felt my way, I gave grants to people from dissidents from Hungary and Poland, and so to come to America. And I got to know them, and then based on that, I started by setting up a foundation in Hungary, and that was the beginning of the activity, which is really was empowering the people who were on the ground. Trying to create an open society, undermine at the time an authoritarian, oppressive regime by creating alternatives. They really had the idea how to go about it, and that gave me the idea that that's really a very effective way. And then I sought out other people in other countries and set up foundations when possible.
Let's look at some of the work your foundation has done in Sarajevo. As we record this, a ceasefire has just gone into effect in Sarajevo. What are some of the projects you've funded there?
Well, the most successful projects were a supply of water, which by using, by putting in a water purification system in a tunnel, which was then providing some water. Then we extended the gas pipelines when there was gas. We gave seeds to people to plant on their terraces so they could grow vegetables for themselves or on the ground. And then towards the end, we strung an electric cable through the tunnel under the airport, and that was the only source of electricity in recent months. That is what kept the hospital going, and we also put in a blood making machine in the hospital, so they had synthetic blood. So those were some of the really successful ventures, and they were designed by Fred Cuny, a disaster expert who has since perished in Chechnya. So it was really, let's say, his genius that has turned my money into something very effective in Sarajevo.
I want to get back to Fred Cuny in a moment. But, you know, looking at Sarajevo, I think in addition to, you know, the money being used to provide gas and water for the people who were under siege, I think you also funded a film festival and helped to fund the production of a Beckett play.
Well, that is, you see, that is the normal activity of a open society foundation. In other words, in Sarajevo, there is a foundation which I support, which is run by the people of Sarajevo, who really stand for, civilization, so to speak. The idea of an open society, the multi-ethnic, civic concept of citizenship. And that is the foundation's those are all activities decided by the foundation. The other ones that I talked about were a special effort, a humanitarian effort, that were sort of parallel and separate from the activities of the foundation.
I guess I'm interested in the equation in your mind of how much money you want to spend on life and death kinds of things like water and things that make life more livable or more bearable, like a film festival or the production of a play.
Well, my goal has been to spend the money on cultural and institutional development and development of an open, what I call an open society. It's really a political goal of creating a pluralistic society where there's critical thinking, where people have respect for other people's opinion, where it's this is really the goal of the foundations. And in a way, when I got involved in the humanitarian mission in Bosnia, it was an admission of defeat. It's an admission that we have failed as open societies to prevent the horrible carnage and disaster that occurred in Bosnia. So I couldn't sort of stay away from it. I felt I had to make a contribution to that. But that's not where I want to spend my money.
Let's look back on Sarajevo for a minute. Looking back, what would you say was the most successful and the most frustrating aspects of the work that you funded? I mean, what lessons have you learned, not from the war, but from watching your money work?
I think that the Sarajevo effort, as an effort, was very successful. It made a significant contribution to allowing Sarajevo to survive. I think that is fair statement. And I think that the foundation itself has been very important in maintaining this spirit of open society, the civic concept as opposed to the ethnic concept of humanity, which in my opinion was the main issue in Sarajevo. But the operation was successful, but the patient is dead. I mean, the civic concept has actually been defeated. And even though we now have come in and we've managed to bring a ceasefire, I think that the damage is done, and we should recognize this.
Does that mean if you had it to do over again, you wouldn't invest in Sarajevo?
No, I would do it. No, absolutely, because there are certain principles. In contrast to investing in the stock market, where you go for gain, let's say, investing in a foundation, you are standing for certain principles. And those principles often are defeated. And nevertheless, you have to stand up for them. I mean, I'm not as courageous as a lot of people who give their lives for a principle. I only give money. But it's the same spirit in which I give it. In other words, it's not a question only a question of succeeding. There are certain things you have to stand for, even if you're defeated.
George Soros has a new book called Soros on Soros. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from Hyperion, publisher of Chain of Evidence, the new book from Ridley Pearson. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with billionaire George Soros about making money through a controversial approach to investing and giving money away to promote education, democracy, and peace. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Emmylou Harris. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with George Soros, perhaps the most successful and powerful investor in the world. He's made billions speculating in the foreign currency markets, and he's given away millions to projects that promote peace, democracy, education, and culture in such places as South Africa, Bosnia, and the former Soviet Union. Soros has a new book called Soros on Soros about his controversial style of investing and his approach to philanthropy. Your fund funded the work of Fred Kuhne while he, under fire, rebuilt gas and water lines in Sarajevo so people under siege could have gas and water. He risked his life to do that, but he survived. Later, on a humanitarian mission funded by your group in Chechnya, he disappeared and his body was never found. His family, after conducting a long investigation, is now certain that he's dead.
Yes.
I'm wondering what impact his death had on you and on your feelings about how much risk you wanted people who you fund to take.
Well, that's a very troubling issue, and I have no moral compunction about Fred Kuhne's death, because he took that risk.
He took it upon himself?
Absolutely. He was. I was not pushing him in any way. In fact, frankly, I was trying to restrain him because, I think he was taking undue risks. So I don't have any of that sense in connection with him. But there were, let's say, two drivers in volunteer drivers, English, who died on the road to Sarajevo. And that, well, they also volunteered, of course. This was on, the same, on that mountain road where the American diplomats perished.
Right.
Also, two of our drivers were killed.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they were volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that since I'm empowering people, it's their choice to do it. And I don't feel that kind of remorse that I would feel, let's say, if I were giving money to, the Northern Irish terrorists who then blow up innocent people. You know, that is what I think one should not do with one's money.
So there's not going to be any changes in how you use money or you fund as a result of this?
None whatsoever, because if there's another Fred Kuhne, I'd be happy to fund him. But it kind of reinforced in me the desire to not to get sucked into humanitarian activities, refugee relief and that kind of thing, because I think that our role, the foundation's role, is to prevent such humanitarian disasters from occurring. In other words, help to resolve ethnic problems, help these countries to become open societies which avoid war. And that is where I think we can make a greater contribution.
Well, let me ask you to choose a project that the Open Society Fund is working on now that you think exemplifies the work that you ought to be doing that can help prevent a crisis.
Yes. Well, we spend about a third of our budget on education, and we just had a conference of all the people involved in all these countries, starting from kindergarten, where we are basically introducing the methods of the Head Start program to the various countries and changing the way children are taught, and they are encouraged to think for themselves. The parents are encouraged to be involved through secondary school to the universities. I think that's the activity that has a chance of making a contribution to open society.
In the early days of your Open Society Fund, I believe you invested in a lot of Xerox machines for countries in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's in a way, it's kind of a continuation of the same idea, because those Xerox machines really enabled people to express their views in ways that the then government didn't particularly appreciate. So it broke this the monopoly of dogma, and it was effective far beyond the cost that those machines cost.
Now, how'd you get them in? I mean, if the government doesn't want underground publications or freedom of speech, how do you get in all the Xerox machines?
Well, the institutes, the scientific institutes and libraries and universities were absolutely dying for a method of duplicating material. So the government could not really object to that because they had to pretend to be serving the interests of the people. So however, there were very strict regulations about who can use Xerox machines, and they were kept under lock and key. And that's the control that we managed to break by introducing a large number of machines that could not then be controlled.
Why couldn't they be controlled? Why couldn't they just lock up more machines?
Well, they could, but the people who were supposed to enforce the regulations were not interested in doing so. I mean,
did you see to it that there was a way to circumvent the regulations? Because that's something you could control.
We made some conditions that the machines had to be available to the public in order to be installed in a library. The library had to make it available to the users of the. That was a condition.
Okay. Now, after the Soviet Union collapsed, you gave grants to, tell me if I have this figure right, 30,000 science professors?
A little over 30,000. That was another major sort of special project, and that was to preserve the core, the best of the Soviet science, because science in the Soviet Union was actually world class, as you know, and it's a different strain from the science in our society, American or Western science. It's sort of more speculative, less technical, very inventive, and it was worth preserving for humanity. And also politically, it played a very important role because it was a refuge for people who thought for themselves, who were not just machines, cogs in the governmental machine. So this was a refuge for independent thinking. And it had a major role in the eventual internal transformation of the system. I mean, Sakharov is, of course, the symbol of independent thinking, but there were a lot of little would-be Sakharovs in these institutes. So it was, I think, it was important to preserve this core of well-educated people who cared about society. And there was an economic collapse, so the institutes were in dire straits. And this was a kind of a first aid, a temporary first aid on a very large scale. I devoted $100 million to that. And we gave only $500 a person at that time was enough to live on for a year. So we were able, as a first step, to give these grants to over 30,000 scientists. And that was, I would say, played a role in preserving science in Russia.
My guest is billionaire, speculator, and philanthropist George Soros. He has a new book called Soros on Soros. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
George Soros is my guest, and he's considered by many to be the most powerful and successful private investor in the world today. He has a new book called Soros on Soros. You have really helped an extraordinary number of people around the world. On the other hand, your methods have been criticized, too. People have said you give a lot of money to countries and then meddle in their internal affairs. For instance, you often meet with heads of state, and people wonder, you know, are you trying to control the political destiny of countries in a way that is more power than one man ought to have?
Well, it's not certainly not one man, because in each country we have a foundation. It consists of citizens of that country who take the responsibility for the actions of the foundation. And so as long as they stand there and they stand for those principles, I am ready to support them. So, yes, we are trying to influence the nature of social organization in those countries. But it's the people in the country who are trying to do it, and I'm there to support them. And I think that is in my opinion, fully justified. And I stand for these, let's say, general universal principles of open society, like human rights, freedom of expression, etc. And I do think that those are universal concepts, and that no country should be isolated and should be exempt from outside influence. Now, the people who want an authoritarian regime generally want to exclude outside influence, and I am an outside influence, and therefore they often oppose me. That's where the conflicts come.
Morton Abramowitz, the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, was quoted in The New Yorker as saying about you, "You're the only man in the U.S. who has his own foreign policy and can implement it." I mean, and the question arises, how do we feel about one man having that much power?
Well, I'm glad to have that much influence. And if I could have more, I would take it. I think that this part of my activity is very much, I think, on moral grounds and ethical grounds. And I'll defend it. It doesn't mean that you couldn't have other people, for instance, supporting terrorists. And I would take exception to that.
George Soros is my guest, and he's considered the most powerful and successful private investor in the world. He's also given his money away faster than just about anyone else alive, invested a lot of money in what he calls the Open Society Fund. Let me ask you about a formative experience in your life. You grew up in Hungary. During the Nazi invasion, your father virtually saved the family. You say your father knew how to act during war. What did your father do to save the family?
He basically arranged for safe haven for all of us. Usually it involved getting false papers, false identity papers, and finding a family that would take us in, or in the case of my brother, he just rented a room, and basically going into hiding.
You're Jewish, so you were disguised as non-Jewish people?
That's right. That's right, because as Jews, we would have been deported.
So what was your disguise?
I became the godson of an official of the Ministry of Agriculture, whose job it was to take over Jewish properties. So I actually traveled with him to the country when he seized these properties. That was my original disguise.
Is there any connection, do you think, between living with this great sense of risk when you were disguised as somebody else and all the risks you've been taking ever since in your life?
No, I think that there's a pretty direct connection, because if you take risks, you want to be sure that you survive. Of course, not everybody who takes risks survives, but I, so far I have. And I think that the art of survival is one that I have learned from my father, because he was a grandmaster in that art. He not only did he survive and brought his family through, but he helped a fairly large number of people, like a couple of dozen people, also to survive. And before that, he lived through the Russian Revolution in Siberia. So he had two experiences in life like that.
One common reaction to risk-taking is upset stomachs, headaches, sleeplessness. What do you like about taking huge financial risks?
Well, I don't like that part, and it is a tremendous burden, a tremendous penalty you pay. I used to have backaches. That was my way of reacting to strain. And in fact, that was as usually a very valid signal that something is wrong in my portfolio. So I actually used it in a way as such. But the strain is tremendous, and I was very anxious to get out of it. When I was reasonably successful, it took me a long time to work my way out, and I was fortunate that I managed to come out on top, because today I'm not personally responsible for taking any decision. I always have someone else responsible.
You're not directly managing the
fund
right. anymore.
That's right. And that is what gives me my sense of, that enables me to do these other things, because otherwise I would be so wrapped up in that activity that I certainly wouldn't have the energy or the ability to do anything else.
I want to get back to your father for a moment. Mm. He was he knew Esperanto, the international language that never caught on.
That's right.
Did he teach that? I mean,
no. But he founded the first international Esperanto literary magazine,
Literatura, wow.
Literatura Mondo. So he was quite active in.
Now, wouldn't that have been great for you if it caught on? Think of all the different countries you have to go in and probably use a translator, right? If they were Esperanto, you'd be in good shape.
Yes, but you see, what happened is that really English supplanted Esperanto as the lingua franca. It was a great idea before the First World War, when French, English, German were more or less equivalent in importance, and that was a neutral language, international language. But now I think English has emerged and in fact the university that I founded, the Central European University, uses English as its language of teaching.
When you're very rich, I would imagine, especially when you give away as much money as you do, people must see you as the really, really super rich guy who, if I behave well, might give me some money. Does that happen to you all the time? Do people relate to you as?
Well, it's a difficult thing. It puts a little barrier between you and most people, and it really makes it difficult for me to have relations, normal relations with people. But there are some people who can put themselves past it, and they are my friends.
Now, do you mind not having normal relations with a lot of people?
No, actually, I'm quite happy to keep a certain distance from most of the people. And people who hope to get a personal grant never do. I know how to protect myself.
Now, this might be too personal to ask, but have you thought about how much money you want to leave to your children? How much is enough? How much is too much? How much might be unhealthy? How much?
Well, I thought a lot about it, and I haven't been as courageous as I should have been. I kept on telling my children that in order to make really successful, worthy people out of them, I ought to go broke. But I wasn't willing to make that sacrifice for them, so I've mistreated them in that way.
So you still want to leave them?
Well, they're taken care of. They are taken care of, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
George Soros has a new book called Soros on Soros. This is Fresh Air. She may not sell millions of albums, but Emmylou Harris has become one of country music's most esteemed performers. Her fans cherish the simplicity of Harris's recordings and the country traditionalism she's maintained. Until now, Harris's new album, Wrecking Ball, is a collaboration with producer Daniel Lanois. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Wrecking Ball is an intriguing departure for Harris.
Glass everywhere, and a baby stares out with motherless eyes, and the long run beauty on fields of war, traveling lament to the poet's core. Oh, where, oh, where will I be?
The first thing that strikes you when you hear this album is the way Daniel Lanois has deployed Emmylou Harris's voice. He uses it most often here as a sort of ghostly presence, floating over the echoing rhythms that are Lanois's trademark. That song, Where Will I Be, was written by Lanois, and it's less a real pop song than a kind of chanted dirge, not unlike the kind of music Lanois has made with U2. A song with a surer sense of melody is this lovely version of a tune by Neil Young, Wrecking Ball. The most significant characteristic of Emmylou Harris's voice is its sense of vulnerability. She savors a paradox, strong vocal cords that convey fragility. I like the way on Wrecking Ball her voice seems to be straining both to hit the notes and straining with romantic longing. She can't wait to be at this dance with her boyfriend, and yet the tune and Neil Young's backup vocals carry a sense of foreboding, as if something bad may happen. It's no wonder they named the album after this song. Wrecking Ball contains a number of covers, including songs by Steve Earle, Anna McGarrigle, and this Lucinda Williams beauty, Sweet Old World.
See what you lost when you left this world. This sweet old world. See what you lost when you left this world. This sweet old world. The breath from your own lips, the touch of fingertips, a sweet and tender kiss, the sound of a midnight train wearing someone's dream. So
I've always been slightly put off by most of Harris's previous albums. Too often it seems to me that she strives for a kind of purity that comes off sterile, lacking in messy emotionalism. But I also can't say that Wrecking Ball is a complete success because its music grows monotonous. Landois thinks dragging everything into a medium tempo automatically invests it with ruminative power. It doesn't. Still, as a departure for Emmylou Harris, it's an eccentric project that certainly won't alienate her admirers.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Emmylou Harris's new album, Wrecking Ball. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. We had help this week from Tina Brock. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Intimate Worlds, Life Inside the Family by Maggie Scarf, author of Intimate Partners. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.